June 2026 Best Buy's staying one step ahead of the predators, and thriving editors note, this is Porter & Company's Best Buys, which we release to paid subscribers on the fourth Saturday of each month. Carmela Tioli wished she still had a scalp. But after the 14-year-old's hair got caught in the cotton-twisting machine at the American Woolen Company in Lawrence, Massachusetts, where she'd been working full-time since she was 13, she was left with a 6-inch bald spot, 7 months in the hospital, and no back pay or workers' comp. It was 1912, and the textile workers of Lawrence were fed up. Massachusetts wove and spun about 1/5 of America's cloth, and mill workers, mostly women and children, who made today's equivalent of $13,000 a year while living in meager company housing, felt like slaves. A January 1st round of docked paychecks was the last straw. Egged on by the Socialist Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, known as the Wobblies, employees took to the streets demanding bread and roses, meaning they wanted something above a subsistence wage. Firebombs were lobbed. A couple of people died. Midway through the strike, the Wobblies' ringleaders were tossed in jail, all of which led to a mass exodus of child workers on February 24. As an IWW-organized political theater stunt, the mothers of Lawrence loaded up 165 child workers on a train to ship them away from the mills. City authorities dragged the mothers and children off the station platform by their hair. Thankfully, no one was scalped this time. The brawl at the train station caught President William Howard Taft's attention. He ordered a congressional investigation, which turned up plenty of dirt, respiratory infections from lint and dust that shortened the average mill worker's life to 40 years, and gruesome on-site injuries. After a parade of child workers, with young, bald Carmela in the starring spot, took the stand to describe their miserable lives, the mill owners gave in. On March 14, 9 weeks after the protest began, the Lawrence bosses agreed to a 15% raise and overtime pay bumps. To make sure the deal stayed intact, workers organized a group of robust union members to breathe down factory owners' necks. Score one for the Wobblies. It was America's first official minimum wage raise, and it ended up destroying Massachusetts' entire textiles industry. Emboldened by the Lawrence workers' victory, mill hands across the state quickly organized protests of their own, and employers across the state rolled over. 2 weeks after the end of the Bread and Roses March, 275,000 textiles workers across New England had secured a 15% raise. Paradise for workers is hell for employers. Over the next several decades, the big textile mills either went bankrupt or packed up and left Massachusetts for greener pastures, namely, the rolling cotton fields of Georgia and Alabama, where no one would make them do a damn thing they didn't want to do. It was a textbook case of capital flowing where it's treated best, and a very personal cautionary tale for the thousands of former strikers left sitting in unheated mill houses, clutching now worthless company scrip. Without the textiles industry, Massachusetts was a wasteland. By the 1940s, unemployment statewide had soared to over 20%. A third of the shoe industry was gone. Textile imports from foreign countries went up by 115%, since America had to get its clothes from somewhere. With the captains of industry off smoking cigars on southern verandas, it was up to the eggheads at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, to fix the problem. Namely, Georges Doriot and Carl Compton. Doriot was a soldier and inventor who came up with Doron plate armor, a forerunner to the Kevlar vest, and Compton, an electron physicist, believed that a reasonably high birth rate of new undertakings in technology would solve Massachusetts' employment woes. The tech industry just needed, so to speak, a midwife. In a bid to bring work, any kind of work, back to the Massachusetts job desert, the two of them proposed a new idea, a private equity company that would invest in promising technology startups. Actually, the new idea was private equity, period. The power law pops back up. Doriot, today known as the father of venture capital, came up with a mechanism to secure multiple investments at once. Up till then, capital infusions generally came from one or two wealthy families with deep pockets. But Compton and Doriot figured they'd tap into a circle of institutions instead, and make the shakedown less painful by proposing staggered rounds of funding called tranches. The new products committee, launched in 1939, would go on to garner backing from MIT, three other universities, the Massachusetts Investment Trust, and a life insurance company, although one potential investor, unconvinced, called it more of a social experiment than a profit-seeking entity. After a brief commercial break for World War II, during which Doriot invented the proto-Kevlar vest, Doriot and Compton were back at it, and soon solidified the new products committee into an official corporation, ARD, American Research and Development Corporation. Over the next quarter century, ARD would go on to generate an average return of 14.7% and spawn an entire universe of other private equity vehicles. In the process, it would also bring plenty of new tech jobs to Massachusetts. Tech nerds know ARD today for a single, spectacular investment it made in the mid-1950s, Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC. DEC was an IBM competitor that built smaller, cheaper mainframe computers, ironically, in a former textile mill. ARD put up a modest $70,000 stake and, in just 14 years, after DEC went public with the world's first mass-produced minicomputer, had turned a 407% profit. DEC, wool mill and all, would go on to become Massachusetts' biggest employer, and a cash cow for ARD, over the private equity firm's 25-year life, including some 117 investments, over half of its profits came from December. If that skew sounds familiar, it should. It's a power law number. As we've written before, and as Italian scholar Vilfredo Pareto first observed in the 1800s, around 80% of the results tend to come from around 20% of the effort. That's right, 20% of businesses generate 80% of the wealth. It's a seemingly immutable law of the universe, although no one seems to know why. But this story isn't about that. This story is about the dark side of the power law. The other side, dark side of the moon. The question no one ever asks is, what happens to the power law losers? The 80% of peasants who don't get any land. The 80% of venture capital investments that crash and burn. Technically, that number is 75%. A full 75% of companies bought by private equity firms lose money for investors, with about 40% of those companies actually going bankrupt. The 25% of remaining private equity, PE, purchases, these days, mostly AI and tech companies, are where the $11 trillion AUM, assets under management, PE racket makes all its money. That hasn't changed much from the Massachusetts birth of venture capital up till present day. It's also not a great track record of success, if you think about it. If anything, a private equity leveraged buyout, LBO, is often the kiss of death for a smaller company. Just look at what happened to Toys R Us, and Claire's, and Sears, and Radio Shack. On paper, of course, all is sweetness and light. BlackRock purchases the struggling wing joint to turn it around, or so the story goes. And you'll get the select success story, Jersey Mike's, for instance, or McAllister's Deli. But most of the time, PE buys these floundering companies, 75% of all purchases, just to gut them. They whip out the sale leaseback, where they sell the company's real estate and then make it pay rent, or the LBO, where they borrow cash to buy the company, and then stick the company with the debt. When the franchise is sucked dry, all the funds can be plowed back into the next big tech purchase, the next power law win. You can see this happening in real time in the stock market, which is quietly shrinking year by year as private equity pulls companies out and delists them. Since the 1990s, over 50% of companies have quietly vanished from the NYSE. And rarely, if ever, are they relisted. Venture capital takes these businesses private and then eats them alive. Nowhere is this more apparent than in the restaurant industry. Over the past decade, PE has been on a restaurant shopping spree, bulk buying mid-level restaurant chains that have been squeezed by inflation and changing consumer habits. Between 2014 and 2024, they've invested $94 billion in bars and restaurants. These restaurants are not part of the elite 25%. Private equity buys weak sauce burger joints to plunder, like they did with TGI Fridays and Red Lobster. Right now, dozens of eateries are on the PE cutting board. At this point, if you see private equity interest in a restaurant, you know the clock is ticking for that establishment. And if you see a standout chain restaurant that has not been chewed up by private equity, you know it must have a robust business. That is the case with the new Best Buy we are adding today. This company's closest twin competitor has just been purchased by a predatory private equity firm, and is likely not long for this world. But our recommendation, a popular pizza maker, has avoided the private equity trap, and for good reason. 1. Domino's Pizza, NYSE, DPZ. Domino's Pizza, NYSE, DPZ, is the franchisor of the world's largest pizza chain with annual revenue of around $5 billion. Why we recommended Domino's Pizza? In 1960, Tom Monahan launched a pizza delivery store concept that has since grown into the pizza empire known as Domino's. Today, it's the largest pizza company in the world, with more than 22,000 franchise locations in over 90 countries. The secret to Monahan's success was speed. He borrowed heavily from the McDonald's, MCD, playbook to create an assembly line style kitchen built for one objective: get hot pizzas into customers' hands within 30 minutes of their order, a goal that remains baked into the company's DNA. Like McDonald's, Domino's thrived not by making the highest quality pizza, but by offering customers the greatest convenience. And as the company expanded in size, the sheer scale of its operations became its most enduring and self-reinforcing competitive advantage. Each new store added into its network shrinks the distance between its pizza kitchens and customers. And with an unmatched global store footprint, Domino's consistently beats the competition with faster delivery times. The company has further expanded its scale advantage by investing into the world's largest logistics chain for sourcing pizza ingredients. Domino's actually makes most of its revenue selling ingredients to franchisees. It doesn't require store owners to buy dough and other supplies from the corporate distribution centers, but it created a natural incentive to do so with a profit-sharing agreement. Any franchisee that sources all of its ingredients from Domino's can earn 50% of the pre-tax profits from the sale. This rebate significantly reduces the net ingredient costs for franchisees. This is a win-win for both parties, as Domino's unmatched bulk purchases give it a major cost advantage. These savings can then be passed on to the consumer, stoking further demand that leads to more Domino's stores, which in turn amplifies the scale advantage for the entire organization. What we like most about Domino's is its franchise business model. As a franchisor, Domino's doesn't pay for any of the costs of launching or operating its restaurants. It simply provides the brand name, infrastructure, and ingredient supply chain in exchange for a 5.5% royalty from every dollar that flows through the register. We love a business that can grow without putting up any of the upfront capital or incurring operating expenses associated with that growth. That's how the company has generated an average return on invested capital, ROIC, of 59% over the last 5 years. And with minimal capital requirements for its core business, Domino's generates $650 million in free cash flow each year. It returns that cash to shareholders through dividends, currently paying a 2.8% annual dividend, and an aggressive share buyback program that has slashed its share count by 38% over the last decade. Why Domino's Pizza is a best buy? This shrinking share count has helped boost the company's earnings per share by 400% over the last decade. Historically, the company has traded at a premium valuation given its exceptional ROIC and consistent earnings growth. But after a 50% decline in the stock price, investors have the rare opportunity to buy shares at a dirt cheap price. Domino's shares have taken a hit from the same factor pressuring the entire fast food industry, low-income consumers suffering an erosion of their purchasing power. After 5 years of inflation running hot, these consumers have increasingly pulled back on discretionary purchases, like ordering fast food. We've seen this show up in significant declines in the key demand metric of same-store sales, SSS, across the entire fast food industry. However, the strength in Domino's brand has shown up in its persistent outperformance of its top two rivals, Pizza Hut and Papa John's, both of which have posted ongoing SSS declines in each of the last 3 years, versus consistently positive SSS results for Domino's. So while Domino's SSS growth rate has declined from its prior trajectory of mid-single-digit or even double-digit growth, down to 1% to 3% in recent years, the company has taken market share throughout the last 3 years of industry-wide declines. Our view is simple. As long as Domino's remains the clear category winner, we see no reason why it won't emerge from today's downturn in an even stronger position, with greater scale and a more entrenched competitive moat. In the meantime, the macro-driven weakness has created an opportunity to buy shares at just 16x earnings, the lowest valuation of the last 14 years, and a roughly 30% discount to the overall market. Investors who bought Domino's when shares last traded this cheaply in 2012 went on to earn a 10x return, or 19% compounded annually. We believe the same opportunity is at hand today. Action to take: buy Domino's Pizza, NYSE, DPZ, up to $467.27 per share to Diageo, NYSE, Deo, Diageo, NYSE, Deo, is the world's largest spirits maker, generating more than $20 billion in annual revenue. Why we recommended Diageo last year? Diageo generated $21 billion in sales from more than 200 brands sold in 180 countries. The company owns many of the world's best-selling spirits brands, including Johnnie Walker Scotch Whiskey, Crown Royal Canadian Whiskey, Smirnoff Vodka, and Don Julio and Casamigos Tequilas. It also owns the third-largest beer brand globally, Guinness, which was founded in 1759 by Arthur Guinness. At the heart of Diageo's business is a core portfolio of forever brands, long-established brands, often more than a century old, that provide a reliable source of consistent profit growth. Diageo's world-class marketing and distribution machine keeps these brands highly visible and selling worldwide. Along the way, the company reinvests a portion of profits from its core portfolio into emerging brands to capitalize on shifting consumer preferences. As the world's largest spirits maker, Diageo uses powerful economies of scale to turbocharge the growth of these emerging brands into global powerhouses. Why Diageo is a best buy today? The company is navigating a regional divide as it works to stabilize its post-pandemic growth. While North America, the company's largest market, remains a significant drag with organic net sales down 9.4%, A massive surge in emerging markets has provided a critical cushion. In Q3 2026 results released May 6, organic sales grew 17.1% in Africa and 16.2% in Latin America and the Caribbean, driven by strong Scotch performance and pre-FIFA World Cup restocking. These gains helped push total organic net sales to a modest 0.3% growth, a notable improvement from the decline seen in the first half of the fiscal year. While the category has fallen out of favor because of GLP-1 anxiety, a younger cohort drinking less, the sober curious narrative, this pessimism is why this Lindy business is being discounted. But note that spirits have survived every prior this time is different, from Prohibition forward, and the brands that survived are the ones Diageo holds. The stock trades roughly 31% off its high, near a 52-week low, at less than 13x forward earnings with a 4% yield, a compelling valuation for a business and brand of this caliber. But the bad news is already reflected in the share price and dividend. In its February results, Diageo redirected dividend cash to pay off debt. Looking ahead, management maintained full-year guidance for organic net sales to decline 2% to 3%. A recent tactical boost emerged on April 30 following reports of potential tariff removals on Scotch whisky, providing some relief to valuation levels that recently hit 20-year lows. While the emerging market momentum is promising, a sustained stock recovery likely depends on stabilizing the North American portfolio and on the August Capital Markets Day, where Diageo's leadership team will unveil a comprehensive strategic refresh for the company. New CEO Dave Lewis will deliver a full strategic refresh alongside fiscal year results on August 6, when the market will get its first real read on whether North America begins to recover. We are adding Diageo as a best buy. The beverage giant is a franchise trading at a distressed multiple, with a now defensible dividend, ahead of the August news that could push shares higher. Action to take: buy Diageo, NYSE, DIO, up $113.52. 3. British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, is the world's second largest nicotine company. Why we recommended British American Tobacco this year? British Tobacco is on track to generate $35.4 billion in revenue and $9.2 billion in free cash flow, FCF. That puts it just behind the industry leader, Philip Morris, which analysts forecast will generate $43.5 billion in revenue and $12.9 billion in FCF this year. We're bullish on British Tobacco's Velo brand of nicotine pouches. The company launched a reformulated version, called Velo Plus, in the US at the end of 2024. Since then, it's quickly become the fastest-growing nicotine pouch brand in America, with $1.5 billion in sales last year. And whereas Philip Morris's ZYN sales have decelerated in recent quarters, Velo's growth has accelerated to 50% annual growth in each of the last 2 years. The brand is quickly approaching 20% market share in the US and is already number one in Europe. The success of Velo Plus has fueled accelerating growth in British American Tobacco's non-combustibles segment, which now makes up 18% of total revenue, and is on track to reach 22% by 2027. As British Tobacco follows in the footsteps of Philip Morris and accelerates its transformation toward less harmful nicotine consumption, we expect the shares will benefit from faster earnings growth and a higher valuation multiple. Why British American Tobacco is a best buy? Despite generating 70% of the FCF as its top competitor, British Tobacco's $133 billion market cap reflects a 55% discount to Philip Morris' $283 billion market cap. We believe this valuation gap will narrow significantly in the years ahead, sending the BTI share price to new all-time highs. The catalyst for this move higher will be the same one that sent Philip Morris' share price up over 100% to new record highs in recent years: booming demand for less harmful nicotine products. BTI shares have already rallied significantly as the company's smoke-free prospects have improved with the early success of Velo Plus, but we see further upside ahead. With the stock currently trading at less than 15x this year's expected FCF, we believe the market is underestimating the upside potential. We see a scenario where BTI shares appreciate to the same low 20s valuation multiple commanded by Philip Morris. That puts our price target at approximately $80 per share, or a 30% upside from a recent price of $61. Action to take: buy British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, up to $86.54 per share every month. We highlight three current recommendations that are at an attractive buy point, and we include those with the best buying opportunity as our best buys. While we sometimes alternate which companies we list as our best buys, removing a stock from the list does not necessarily mean we no longer recommend it, nor does it imply a recommendation to sell shares in that company once it is no longer a best buys. It's only that the new picks present an even more compelling investment opportunity. Porter & Company. Stevenson, Maryland.